What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
On October 12th, 2002, 25-year-old Paula Wade and her 3-year-old son Brandon were last seen in Valdosta, Georgia, just days before they were supposed to move to Florida for a fresh start. Paula was packing up their apartment and was really looking forward to being closer to family, but they would never get there. When Paula missed a scheduled call with her parents on the 13th and failed to show up to work on the 14th, she and her son were reported missing. Their apartment was searched, and all of their belongings were found inside. More than 20 years later, Paula and Brandon have never been found. Their disappearance remains an open case, and their family has been left wondering what happened to them. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Paula and Brandon's case, although I'm going to refer to Paula a lot because she's the adult in this situation. I want to start by saying that we had the privilege of working with Paula's sister, Mary, on this episode. So thank you to Mary for working with our team and making sure that we had all the facts right. That's super important here, where we have 20 years that have passed and things can get lost in translation. So to have someone who's been there since the very beginning, who probably knows this case better than anybody else, working with us, it's a huge advantage, and I really appreciate it. So this case is another one of those stories where we have a pretty large window where something could have occurred. So it does leave a lot of potential theories that are in play here. But when you start to chip away at it all and narrow it down, there's a few players that really rise to the top. And we're going to discuss one of those main persons of interest. There are a couple, but one that really has a big question mark lingering over his head. And we may be looking at one of those cases where it's not what you know, it's what you can prove. And that's what we're trying to do here, because I do believe in this particular case, there is somebody out there other than this person that knows what happened, and we just have to find them, or maybe we already did. We're also going to talk about Paula's relationship with her husband, because to me, I'm left with more questions than answers, and I'm hoping that there's someone out there with a shared experience that may be able to enlighten me. There's definitely a lot to talk about here, so let's get into this week's case. Paula Ann McGrath was born on October 30th, 1976 in Athens, Greece. She was the youngest child of her parents, Mary and Regis, and had two other siblings who shared those same names. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we worked with Paula's sister, Mary, on this episode, who is 11 years older than Paula. And just for clarity, so we don't get confused, we're going to refer to Paula's sister as Mary and to her parents as Mom and Dad, just so there's a clear distinction. Despite having an 11-year age gap, Paula and Mary were incredibly close. They spent a lot of time together growing up and remained close into adulthood. Because their father was in the Air Force, the family moved frequently, spending much of Paula's childhood living throughout Europe. When Paula was a teenager, the family relocated back to the United States and eventually settled into the Orlando, Florida area. Paula graduated high school there, and she was known as a good student and a kind person. She also reconnected with Lance Wade. Now, this was someone she had known in Germany when their fathers were stationed there. They began a whirlwind romance and eventually got married. By that point, Lance was also serving in the Air Force, and not long after their wedding, he was deployed to Korea for a year. During that time, Paula went to live with her sister Mary, and the two grew even closer while navigating that time period together. When Lance returned from Korea, the couple eventually relocated to Valdosta, Georgia for his next assignment. Valdosta is this small city in south central Georgia near the Florida state line, and at the time Paula and Lance moved there, the population was approximately 40,000 people. They settled into an apartment in the 1400 block of St. Augustine Road, and Paula began working at Sam's Club, where she was known as dependable and hardworking, and over time, she worked her way up into a leadership position. Within a few years, Paula and Lance decided to start a family, and on July 15, 1999, they welcomed their son, Brandon Lee. Mary told us that Paula was glowing when Brandon was born. After wanting to be a mother for so long, she was incredibly proud. Brandon immediately became the center of Paula's world. Mary said that everyone in the family loved him, and they affectionately called him Munchkin, and that nickname came from the fact that he was born early and was very small. After Brandon's birth, Lance was transferred to Shaw Air Force Base in South Carolina, which is about 5.5 hours from Valdosta. Paula asked Sam's Club if she could transfer to a store near there, but there were no leadership openings. So the couple made the decision for Paula and Brandon to remain in Valdosta while Lance reported to his new assignment. With this setup, things were difficult financially, and Paula really struggled to make ends meet. Paula and Lance eventually spoke with their landlord about the situation, and he mentioned a 19-year-old college student who needed a place to stay. And just so you know, I'm going to use the student's real name, which is Marcus Randolph Burroughs, and this is because his name has already been shared publicly by law enforcement. Okay, so after finding out about Marcus, Paula and Lance agreed to let him move in and help with the bills. Lance even helped him move in before going back to South Carolina, and he continued to visit periodically, getting to know Marcus along the way. Now, I do want to point out that it has been reported that Paula and Lance were estranged and getting a divorce at this time, and that Paula had started dating Marcus, but Mary has told us that is absolutely not true. Paula and Lance were still together, and she was not dating Marcus, and I'm going to go with her on this. Although, I will say, and I've talked to everybody about this, and this is the part I was referring to earlier, the relationship, the dynamic between Lance and Paula is off to me. I can't put my finger on it. I believe Mary. I know they were still together. I don't believe there was anything going on romantically between Paula and Marcus. But I'm just going to put it out there because I'm always honest with you guys. And I'm not from a military family. But I know that if I had a wife and a young son, regardless of how difficult it was going to be and what opportunities were in this new location for my wife, they're coming with me. They're coming with me, guys. I'm sorry to say it. If the relationship is good between us, you're coming with me and so is my son. And if for some strange reason I made the decision that you weren't going to come with me, again, you guys can put this on me, but I'm not letting a young man that I barely know move into the house or move into the apartment with my wife and young son. Maybe that's just my history and my experiences as a police officer where I don't trust anyone, but I'd really like you guys to weigh in on this one. And I'm not judging anybody for this, especially not Paula. But as we get into the relationship between Lance and Paula later in this episode, there's going to be some questions that come up. And I bring this part up here to just make sure I'm clear where I stand. And that is that even though Paula and Lance were still together, I do think this could suggest that there were some cracks in the relationship and maybe there was a decision collectively made that they wanted some time apart, or it was just Lance where he was basically over the relationship, couldn't wait to get away, and really didn't care who moved in with his wife. But again, you guys let me know, pause the video, pause the audio, let me know what you think, especially if you're from a military family, whether that's your parents or maybe you were married to someone who was in the military. When they were stationed at another base, did you stay where you were? Did you go with them? And why was that? I'm really looking to be educated on the matter. So by the fall of 2002, Brandon was just over 3 years old and he loved to play ball, eat French fries, and watch Toy Story. And who doesn't love to watch Toy Story, right? And Paula was approaching her 26th birthday. And at that point, things in her life were becoming increasingly difficult. She was still hoping to transfer to a Sam's Club location near Lance, but that opportunity hadn't come yet. And financially, things were getting desperate. Marcus was no longer in college and wasn't contributing, leaving Paula with no money. She spoke with her family to get some guidance, and they encouraged her to either move to be with Lance or relocate to Florida to be closer to them because she couldn't keep living the way she was. Thankfully, shortly after that, Paula received the news that she had been hoping for, which was that a new Sam's Club was opening in the Orlando area, and she was offered a position. Since it meant being closer to her family, she happily accepted the offer. Paula told her family about the good news, and they came up with a plan for her and Brandon to move in with her parents. She began packing up her apartment, and they made arrangements to move the weekend of October 19th, 2002. Paula was extremely excited about this next chapter. She couldn't wait to be near her parents and her sister Mary. She and Mary really wanted their children to grow up around each other, something they hadn't experienced while living on military bases. She talked often about the move and all the possibilities that came with it. But tragically, that move would never happen. And we are just getting started. There's so much to unpack here. We're going to talk about it right after the break. I'm excited to tell you about the world's number one expanding garden hose and their brand new product, the Pocket Hose Ballistic. If you've been a fan of this channel, then you probably have already heard me talk about the Pocket Hose. I absolutely love the thing. It's been already put through the paces and it's held up. I received the 25-foot hose as part of this, you know, the sponsor, and I loved it so much that I purchased the 75-foot hose, and now I have it on both spigots on my house. It's absolutely incredible, extremely durable, and I've talked about it before. I have a French bulldog, shout out Vinny. And anybody who has a French bulldog knows how sharp their teeth are, and he absolutely destroys his dog toys. And so I'm out in the yard, and all of a sudden, while I'm spraying down the grass because I planted some new seed, I feel this yank. Turn around, Vinny's got a mouthful of the pocket hose. And I'm thinking, oh no, this is bad. He's swinging it around in his mouth. I pull on it. He doesn't let go. He thinks we're playing a game. Finally, I pry it out of his death grip, and I'm thinking, okay, there's going to be water ripping out of this thing as soon as I turn it back on. Turn it back on, not a drip. Held up, and he was biting down on it. And at that point, I was sold. I'm like, okay, if it's Vinny approved, we're good to go. And there's so many pieces of technology in this hose. You hear a hose, and you're thinking, how great can it really be? There's over 100 patents, and it's actually made with a crystal polymer, and it's the same material that you'd find in bulletproof vests. And so if it's good enough to stop a bullet, it's definitely good enough for your water. And it's not only strong, it's super lightweight, easy to manage, easy to store. And just like the name suggests, when you turn the water on, it grows. And then when you turn the water off, it shrinks back down to pocket size. So it's super convenient. It also comes with the pocket pivot. This actually not only aesthetically goes with the hose, but it is super convenient. You get that 360-degree rotation. So as you move, it moves with you, not putting tension on the area where the hose connects to the spigot itself, which is important. And now, for a limited time, when you purchase a new Pocket Hose Ballistic, you'll get a free 360-degree rotating pocket pivot and a free thumb drive nozzle, which I also love. Multiple spray options on it, covers everything. And all you have to do is text DETECTIVE to 64000. That's DETECTIVE to 64000 for your two free gifts with your purchase. One more time, text DETECTIVE to 64000. Message and data rates may apply. Okay, we're back, and I want to dive into the timeline that's really critical to this case. So on Saturday, October 12th, Paula went to work at Sam's Club in Valdosta and left at approximately 3 p.m. The following day, She was supposed to speak to her parents at 6:30 p.m. This was a scheduled call that she made every single week without fail. She had never once missed that call. But on Sunday, October 13th, she did. At first, her parents were concerned, but not immediately alarmed. They knew that Paula was busy packing and preparing for the move, and they assumed she may have just simply lost track of time. They expected to hear from her soon, but they never did. Then on Monday, Paula didn't show up for work. This was the first time she had ever missed a shift in 5 years of employment, so her coworkers knew something was wrong. They went to Paula's apartment and saw her 1998 Chevy Blazer in the parking lot. They knocked on the door, but there was no answer. After doing that twice that same day, her coworkers contacted Paula's parents and told them what was going on. Her parents agreed that something was definitely wrong and told them to call the police. Then Paula's parents contacted Mary, told her briefly what was going on, and Mary immediately rushed over to their house. Mary told us that she'll never forget the sound of her mother wailing as she walked up to the home. She said, quote, "It was like somebody had just ripped her heart out." Mary then called Lance to ask if he knew anything, and according to Mary, Lance said that he had not heard from Paula. However, he did not seem concerned that she and Brandon were missing. Instead, he responded by asking, quote, "You think I should go?" As in, "Do you think I should go to Valdosta to see what's going on?" And Mary told him, "Yes, that's exactly what you need to do." And she questioned why he wasn't doing that already. Paula's parents also got into their car and started driving to Valdosta as well. Meanwhile, back in Valdosta, Paula's co-workers contacted the police as instructed. And from what we know, officers then reached out to Paula's landlord and to Lance because the officer didn't know that Lance and Mary had already had a conversation. And apparently, from what we know, when the officer spoke to both of them, no one had seen or heard from her since October 12th. Lance said that he was at Shaw Air Force Base in South Carolina at the time of their disappearance. And I also want to point out, because I know there's probably a lot of side eyes right now at Lance, he did eventually go on to pass a lie detector test, and later police said publicly that he had been cleared of any involvement. I have to go with this because this would be pretty easy to prove and pretty easy to discredit. He's on a military base, right? There's going to be multiple people that would have seen him there. And if he had left without telling anyone, there probably would have been some problems. Now, I don't know what the practices and policies were for coming onto the base and leaving, but it's a military base. There's security there. So there would be some record of it, I would believe. I don't think there's going to be a mass conspiracy where people are going to cover up the fact that he left. So I do believe that this has been vetted and proven to be true. So at minimum, we can say Lance didn't have anything physically to do with Paula and Brandon's disappearance. Doesn't completely clear him in my eyes, but law enforcement knows more than me. And as I stated, he was cleared of any involvement. So if you want to go with that, we can go with that. When Paula's parents arrived in Valdosta, they explained to the police that it was completely out of character for Paula to miss work or go without contacting her family. They also emphasized that Paula and Brandon were about to move to Florida, something Paula was extremely excited about, and there was no reason for her to leave voluntarily. Officers searched inside the apartment, and all of Paula and Brandon's belongings were still there. Paula's wallet, military ID, purse, and glasses, all things she would need. Mary told us that Paula really relied on her glasses due to poor eyesight and needed them just to see someone standing right in front of her. So seeing her glasses there was a huge red flag. Another red flag was Paula's military ID still being there. Mary told us that because they grew up in a military family, it was deeply ingrained in them to never leave home without an ID, and she said Paula would not have left willingly without it. There were also other items there that left Paula's family with even more concerns. Brandon's music tape and blanket that he needed to fall asleep were still in the home. There was also a new pair of shoes, along with boxes Paula had been packing for the upcoming move. Officers also searched Paula's car, which wasn't actually there when they first arrived. Marcus showed up driving it, and when he saw the police, he actually turned around. Eventually, he came back, and the car was searched, but according to law enforcement, there were no signs of struggle. Now, what does that mean? how involved was the search? What was the level of investigation or forensic analysis that was conducted on the vehicle to ensure that there was nothing in the car worth preserving or collecting? Something else I want to mention is that Brandon's car seat was reported missing. And I say reportedly because Mary told us that there has been inconsistent information about that over the years. More than 20 years later, witnesses can't clearly recall whether they saw a car seat or not. So the jury's still out on that one. So after completing a search of Paula's apartment and her car, the police told her family that they didn't think anything was wrong. They believed that Paula and Brandon left voluntarily, so she could be back anytime. They would just have to wait a little longer. I will say they did file an incident report, which I have on the screen right now, but according to the family, they didn't do much with it. So if you look at the incident report, if you're on YouTube, you can see it on the screen here. And based on what I'm seeing here, I tend to agree with Paula's family if I'm trying to be objective. You can see at the top of the report, it is labeled a missing person report. So there was enough there for them to take the report, right? But it does appear that it might have been just something to appease the family, because if you look further down at the narrative, there's really nothing documented. Just simply, yeah, they're reporting that she's missing and she hasn't been found and she can't be located. Like, I've never seen a missing persons report that's compiled of three sentences. And so for me, this shows a level of incompetence, right? They're not doing their due diligence. They're not documenting what they're seeing, what they're not seeing. They're not even taking the initiative to just document what was found in the apartment. So that's a problem. And as a sergeant, someone who would receive this report, we're talking 2002. This isn't like back in the Stone Age. This report would be going back to that officer and they would be asked to elaborate on it, because this would not be adequate to submit as something that could potentially be a missing person and their child. So I have a problem with the report, and I'm someone who is pro-law enforcement, and I was talking to the team about this. I'm glad that they took a report. We know that in many instances, that's not even the case. But as far as I know, they did not enter her into NCIC, which is a problem for me. And even though they took the report, it doesn't seem like any actual effort was put into it. So I'm not going to give you just, you know, a pat on the back because you made the effort, because based on what I'm seeing here, it aligns with what the family is reporting, which is that law enforcement didn't take it that serious initially. But as the days passed and Paula and Brandon did not return, the Valdosta Police Department finally started investigating the case. And Paula's family was grateful for this. However, Valdosta did not bring in the Georgia Bureau of Investigation or the FBI, despite the fact that a toddler was missing. Some people may say you don't need them initially. I would lean toward any type of federal assistance you can get. They obviously have more resources available. And as the days pass, there's a higher likelihood that they could have crossed state lines. And if that happens, you definitely can reach out to the FBI. They'll have a resident agent who's in that area who most likely would be more than willing to assist. But at minimum, you bring in the GBI, let them help you out, use their resources, use their personnel. The more people you have working it, the better chance you have at solving it. So the fact that they didn't do that and Paula's family was disappointed by it, again, I agree with them. Paula's parents also had to ensure that Paula and Brandon's information was shared with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and NAMIS. This is not their job. They shouldn't have to do that. But according to them, they had to make that step, and they had to make sure to remind law enforcement, hey, don't forget to do this. And if that's the case, and I have no way to substantiate it, I have a strong suspicion that if I had the ability to talk to law enforcement, they would dispute this. But what else are they going to do? If this is what happened, it's wrong, it's unprofessional, it's unethical, and I can't get behind it. I'm extremely disappointed in it and embarrassed, frankly. And listen, I know when I say things like this, you're like, wow, you're really going hard on the police department when you're only getting one side of the story. But that's all we have, right? This case is over 20 years old and law enforcement is still tight-lipped about it. So if there's information out there that's inaccurate, now's the time to speak up. And if you have proof that you did more than what I'm reporting, I'll be glad to make an amendment and put that out there. But they're not going to do that. And so all I have to go off of is the personal experiences of the victim's family. And it's not like I'm just taking their word and not questioning anything. I get access to the incident report and I see something that is clearly not completed in the manner that it should have been, which aligns with what they're reporting, which is why I feel comfortable calling law enforcement out. Again, if you got something different, if you're working this case and you want to provide something that says otherwise, by all means, bring it. But based on what we're going to talk about later, based on how this incident report was obtained and some of the issues with it, I don't think I'm going to be hearing from the Valdosta Police Department anytime soon. As this investigation began, multiple ground searches were conducted with the help of the Air Force, but there was no sign of Paula or Brandon anywhere. Investigators also began speaking with people connected to Paula, and during that time, they learned that in the days before her disappearance, Paula had told people she was scared, though she didn't explain why. Another witness told investigators that Marcus was upset about Paula's plan to move back to Florida and allegedly said, quote, "I'm going to make sure she stays here." And as you would imagine, based on that comment alone, investigators wanted to speak with Marcus, but at first, they couldn't locate him. So they went to the media and said they were looking for him, and eventually, Marcus was found. He was actually in jail. He had stolen a pizza and given police a false name. So once he was located, investigators attempted to question him about Paula and Brandon. But Marcus was not cooperative. Shocker, right? He told investigators that Paula, quote, had left the other night with Brandon and claimed he hadn't seen or heard from her since. He also said he didn't realize anything was wrong until police contacted him. It's unclear whether Marcus provided any additional information, as Paula's family has never been able to access the case files. What they do know is that police said he refused a polygraph test and eventually asked for an attorney. Even with all of that, he has never been named as a person of interest by law enforcement, but as I mentioned earlier, the police have shared his name publicly. So if you're to ask me, just based on the circumstances I've conveyed to you so far, he absolutely is a person of interest, even without them saying it. It is what it is. I think even he knows that. But he's not the only one who's displaying some questionable behavior. Lance, he's also bothering me too with some of his reactions to all of this. And we're going to talk about Marcus more and some acquaintances of his. We're also going to talk about Lance right after the break. Cravings aren't just about nicotine. They're about habit, the hand-to-mouth motion, oral fixation, the momentary pause. When that loop is broken, cravings spike, and fume replaces your habit with a flavored air fidget device that gives your hand and mouth something to do, distracting cravings without nicotine, vapor, or batteries. So don't just try to quit. Upgrade that habit loop and reach for a fume instead. For those of you who don't know, fume is a flavored air device designed to help people quit smoking or vaping by breaking the hand-to-mouth pattern. Like I just mentioned, no nicotine, no batteries, no vapor, just clean, natural flavors and a fidget-friendly design that actually feels good to use. And if you guys have watched an episode before, then more than likely, you've seen me holding the fume in one of the episodes. I hold it all the time, even when it's not a sponsor. I like the design. It's quality, it's weighted, it's real wood, real metal. It's got the fidget options to it. You got the little twisting and the clicking, the magnets. I have to be careful when I'm recording, though, because the magnets can be loud. So I try to stick to just the twisting, and I hope most of the time you don't hear it. It's also got some amazing flavors. My personal favorite is the orange vanilla, but they also have crisp mint. They have raspberry. So depending on what your preference, they got something for everybody. And if you've never tried Fume before, now is a great time, because when you grab your journey pack, you'll also get a free gift just for using my code DETECTIVE. Fume has already helped over 700,000 people take steps toward better habits, and now it's your turn. Use my code DETECTIVE to get a free gift with your journey pack. All you have to do is head to tryfume.com. That's TRYFUM.com, and use code DETECTIVE to claim your free gift today. All right, we're back, and let's start with Lance. By the end of October, he stopped paying rent on the apartment and got rid of most of Paula and Brandon's belongings. He did not attend any vigils or participate in handing out flyers, and he stopped communicating with Paula's family. This is what I was referring to earlier when I mentioned that there were reports that Lance and Paula were separated and heading toward divorce, and she was dating Marcus. There's nothing to substantiate that there was anything between her and Marcus, and I personally don't believe that there was, based on what I've researched. What I think was going on is that Lance and Paula were on the way out, and there was already some cracks in the marriage, and the opportunity to go to South Carolina was something that Lance was looking forward to and probably didn't want Paula and Brandon following him. So this behavior after the fact, some could look at it as a sign of involvement, and maybe this was him distancing himself because he knew that he had more to do with it than he had let on, and at this point, he felt like he got away with it. Personally, I'm just going to tell you right now, I don't feel that way. I think what I just said is what happened. I think that there was already fractures in the relationship. I still don't agree with his response here. Regardless of the fractures in the relationship, this is the mother of his child. And at minimum, if you care about your son, more than likely, wherever Paula is, that's where Brandon is. So if for no other reason than that, you should have had your ass down there right away, and you should have been part of these vigils and part of the searches and handing out flyers, even if it was just to find your son. So I don't agree with the approach. I don't agree with the response. I wouldn't do it if I were in his shoes, but that doesn't mean he's guilty of a crime. And I have to imagine that he was vetted thoroughly, especially being who he was in this relationship, and he was cleared. And so that's the approach that I'm taking with him. So again, don't like the way he handled it, but I don't think he's involved. Now, around the same time that Lance stopped paying rent, the police also provided an update to the public saying, quote, "We still have a feeling she might be out there on her own somewhere, but we do have some indications of foul play." And Haley had put a note in the script here where she said, Paula's family isn't exactly sure what that means when they say indications of foul play, because as far as they know, law enforcement searched the apartment and everything looked normal, and police still maintain that Lance had no involvement. What I think they're referring to when they say indications of foul play, it's essentially what I've already described. The behavior of Paula leading up to this incident doesn't indicate someone who was planning on running away. She was packing up. She was excited about going and seeing her parents and her sister. She really didn't have the financial ability to run away. And most importantly, if she was going to leave on her own, as I mentioned, she would have taken those very critical items, her glasses, her ID, Brandon's blanket, his tape. These are essentials. These are things that are necessities. She would not have left them behind. So having all of those things in the apartment, even though everything appears to be normal, that in and of itself is a potential indication of foul play, because the only way she would have left those things behind is if she wasn't given a choice. As the investigation continued, investigators brought in an acquaintance of Marcus named Cedric for questioning. Cedric, he had some things to say. He told investigators that Paula and Brandon were dead and that their bodies could be found in a wooded area near their apartment complex. Police did search that area, but only found deer bones. Mary told us that the family didn't know what to make of that information. At the time, Cedric was facing a long prison sentence on unrelated charges, and it was possible he was just trying to cut a deal. They have no idea if his statements were completely false or if there was any truth to them. And you do have to wonder, did Cedric give them good information, but law enforcement just didn't hit on the right spot? Did they search a particular area, but they should have gone, 150 feet over to the left or the right? Very possible. I don't know how big this wooded area is. I was looking on the map. I can see one wooded area. It's pretty extensive, but there's also other areas. I don't know how far we're talking. If they had been killed at the apartment complex, would they bury them that close by? I don't know. So the jury's still out on that one. Just because they didn't find them, it doesn't mean they're not there. On the other hand, it could be just Cedric trying to cut a sweet deal for himself. We've seen that before as well. So you have to proceed with caution here, but I would really like to talk to Cedric more. And on that note, Mary has said that the family attempted to contact Cedric over the years, but he has never responded. Mary has also said that she's unaware if he was ever re-questioned by investigators, which she believes could be a missed opportunity. And I completely agree. If there's any investigators who are working this case and listening or watching right now, you need to bring Cedric in again. You need to see if he's willing to cooperate after all these years. I'll also throw out there, putting my name in the ring, Cedric, if somehow you or someone you know hears or watches this and you don't want to talk to law enforcement, but you're willing to talk to me, I'd be more than willing to fly to you or fly you up here to have that conversation. It can be on camera or it can be off camera. Just know that if you share information that's critical to the case, I'm going to provide it to law enforcement. I have an obligation to do that, not only because it's the right thing to do, but I'm here working for the family at this point. I want to get them answers. And if you can provide them, I'm going to share them. As the investigation continued, there was little to no movement in the case. It seemed to Paula's family that the police were not actively working to find Paula and Brandon, and the family repeatedly pushed for the GBI or the FBI to get involved, but they were told no time and time again. Over the years, communication with the Valdosta Police Department broke down and has remained limited ever since. The family has received very little information and has not been allowed to review any case records. The only document they've been given is the initial report, which they had to obtain through a records request. When the family received the report, it listed the police department as the incident address and included signatures from people who were not even employed there in 2002, including the current detective assigned to the case. When Mary asked about these inconsistencies, she was told she hadn't actually been given the original, she had been given a digital version, which was created after they changed systems. So as you would expect, Mary asked for the original, and when she finally got it, she noticed that the officer who had signed it was on the Brady violation list for falsifying records. Not going to give you a lot of confidence in what you have there. And I've shown the report up on the screen. You can see it for yourself. You never want to have a Brady violation against you. It shows that you're not credible, right? You can't even testify in court. Does that mean he falsified this document? No, I have no way of proving it. And frankly, if they had falsified the document, you would think it would be better than what I showed you guys because it looks pretty piss poor. But receiving a document that's signed by an officer who already has a Brady violation against him, I don't think that's going to be too reassuring. But putting that aside for a minute, let's recap the chain of events here. The family requested the original incident report. What they received was a manufactured document that more than likely was created after the records request was approved. That's a problem. It opens up so many questions. Why would you do that? At minimum, to me, it screams, wow, this initial report was terrible. There was really no investigative effort conducted. Nothing was documented. This is an embarrassment. Let's just send them something else and hope it passes. Fortunately, Mary's too sharp for that. Didn't happen. Didn't get by her. And she eventually got the original document, which I've been criticizing all night. And I think you guys can all understand why. So major issue here. I had mentioned this earlier. It just brings everything into question. Like, I don't think law enforcement is involved in the crime here, but they clearly didn't do their job. And I don't know if this would have made a difference in the case. But when you think about the facts that I've laid out so far and what appears to be a very lackluster investigation when it comes to at least the apartment in the car, you have to assume that the same level of behavior was conducted with the initial questioning of witnesses and persons of interest. And yeah, I think that could have made a difference in the case. So as the years passed and the case went cold, Paula and Brandon's family did not stop searching. They returned to Valdosta every year to raise awareness, continue speaking with the media, and conduct their own investigation. In fact, the family learned that after Paula and Brandon disappeared, Marcus was later arrested in Florida for a traffic violation. Some of you might be sitting there going, well, Derek, it was a traffic violation. Yeah, he was arrested, but that could happen to anyone. Well, what was interesting about this particular arrest was that at the time, his address that he provided was also linked to a family that allegedly owned adoption agencies connected to child trafficking and illegal adoptions. And Paula's family passed that information along with every other tip they received to law enforcement. However, they have rarely received any follow-up or confirmation as to whether those leads were ever investigated. And that's a problem, right? We talk about communication all the time. regardless of how many years have passed. You have to ensure that the family of the victims knows you're still working for them. And it takes you 5 minutes to pick up the phone, give them a call, and check in with them. We're not talking brain surgery here. So to me, reading between the lines, it sounds like the Valdosta Police Department is pissed at Paula's family because they're continuing to be a nuisance. They're continuing to reach out. They're continuing to question their investigation. And this feels retaliatory to me. That's just my opinion. It wouldn't take them much to make a call, and yet they're not doing it. And you have to ask why. And I can't think of any other reason other than they're over it. They don't want to deal with them. And that's extremely unfortunate. And just one additional reason why the GBI and or the FBI need to be involved at this point. And just to switch gears for a moment, throughout this entire time, Lance has remained silent. He didn't speak publicly until October of 2022, when 20 years had passed with no sign of Paula or Brandon. To mark that milestone, he was approached by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children for comment for a blog post. He told them that he had hoped one day someone would knock on his door and say they were his son, but that was it. No mention of Paula, and he hasn't spoken since. And to me, this just reaffirms my belief that there was something going on between him and Paula that we're unaware of. Maybe even Paula's family was unaware of. I don't know what it is. It really doesn't matter. But he clearly has a grudge against her. I don't know what it is. I would go as far as saying, if he were involved, whether it was directly or indirectly, he would be out there more. He would at least pretend like he cares about Paula. He'd be on media outlets saying he's looking for her, he's looking for Brandon, he's doing whatever he can, he thinks about them all the time, they had such a great relationship. He's doing none of that. Instead, he's pulling off the polar opposite, basically indirectly saying, I don't care about Paula at all. Yeah, I wish I could find my son. That's pretty ballsy, especially if you're involved somehow. So I don't like what we're hearing here, but it does align with my belief. And that's that even though they weren't divorced, even though Paula wasn't seeing anybody else, there was a problem in the relationship. And that's the reason that a lot of the things unfolded the way they did. Sadly, by the following year, 2023, both Mary and Paula's parents had passed away without ever knowing what happened to their daughter and their grandson. That left Mary and her brother Regis continuing the fight for answers on their own. They kept pushing for the FBI to get involved, and while the agency eventually agreed to create flyers and post them on their website, they made it clear that they could not formally step in unless requested by law enforcement. But up to this point, the Valdosta Police Department has never made that request. I will say they have assigned a new detective to the case, hoping that a fresh set of eyes might bring new direction or movement. But unfortunately, there have been no new developments, and the relationship between the family and the police remains strained. In fact, there was a recent instance where Mary stated that she had to learn through a news interview that a tip they had provided didn't lead anywhere. And in that same interview, the current detective stated that he found it difficult to believe that they had simply disappeared, saying, quote, "The feeling is, unfortunately, they were murdered and their bodies have been dumped somewhere." Mary told us it was difficult to hear that publicly because investigators have never shared that theory with them directly or provided any explanation as to why they're saying that. Now, really think about this for a second. This is the person on TV who's in charge of finding the people responsible for whatever happened to your loved ones. And he's sitting out there saying they're dead. That's difficult right there on its own. But to hear it through a TV screen instead of from him directly, it's unacceptable. It's inexcusable. That detective needs to make that call to the family first. They are the ones most affected by it. And any case that I'm involved in, I think about it from the perspective of, what if this was my family? What if this was my loved one? What would I want? And as I said earlier, it doesn't take a lot to pick up the phone. But if you're going to go out and make a statement like this, where you're basically indirectly telling them that, hey, it's over, your loved ones are dead, don't you think the right move would be to call them first? Or even better than that, bring them in, sit them down, let them know that this is what you're going to say publicly, and this is why you think that. You owe them that much, regardless of the relationship. Today, Paula and Brandon's case remains unsolved and they have not been located. No suspects or persons of interest have ever been named. Investigators have said the case is still active, and Mary wants to believe that, but without communication, she has no way of knowing what is actually being done. Mary told us that she would like to see a true partnership between law enforcement and the family, and she also believes that bringing in an outside agency like the FBI or the GBI could provide fresh eyes and potentially move the case forward. She firmly believes that someone knows what happened to Paula and Brandon, and her hope is that that person will come forward and share what they know so investigators can finally piece together what happened. Until that day comes, or until her last breath, Mary says she will not stop fighting for answers. All right, let's dive into perspective, and I want to start with the Valdosta Police Department because I was pretty hard on them in this episode, and it's warranted, completely justified. I take none of it back. And the reason that I'm so critical of them in this particular case is that based on what I can see, and it's limited, it doesn't appear that they did a thorough investigation. And could that have contributed to this case not being solved? Absolutely. It's common sense, right? If they put that much effort into locating her, then how much effort did they put into actually interviewing people who might have information that could help solve the case? Probably not a lot, right? Clearly from that narrative, again, we're talking two or three sentences. There wasn't a lot of thought, a lot of effort, a lot of belief in the fact that she was missing. And so when you put that much in, you're not going to get much out. And so I stand behind what I said. I wish it wasn't the case, but you got to call it how you see it. And we got to police the police sometimes. And I respect law enforcement. I know it's a hard job what you guys are doing, but this type of behavior in 2002, any year for that matter, is inexcusable. And for that reason, I am calling for them to bring in an outside agency. I understand they have a detective working this case, but as I mentioned, that detective's the one who put out that public statement without conferring with Paula's family first. Unprofessional. You can't do it. And it's just, the water is too tainted at this point. You need to get the case out of that police department and into someone else's hands, whether that's the GBI or the FBI or a private investigative firm. We need to create some distance between the original investigating agency and whatever entity takes it over. And on that note, let's talk about how many years have passed. 24, right? We're at a point, and I kind of have a template that I use where even though it's an open investigation, the investigating agency has discretion in how much information they release. At minimum, they should be providing it to the family, but at this point, I would say provide it publicly. You've already named certain people. Put everything out there. If you really aren't on a hot lead right now, release it and allow the public to take this thing over. Allow a private investigator to take this thing over. Although there's still time, if there's someone involved with what happened, they've lived the majority of their life as a free person. And that makes my stomach turn. Even if we get them at this point, it's too late, but it's better late than never. That's the way I'm looking at it. And I think if we're going to solve this one, it's going to take someone other than the Valdosta Police Department. So hypothetically, if I were the private investigator working this case, what would I want to do? Well, you take the initial report, you see what you have, doesn't seem like it's going to be a lot, and you reinvestigate everything you can, everything that you still have access to. Where's her car? Where's the apartment? Go look at the area. See what you can pull from just your observations. It's going to be difficult, but it's part of the process. Then I would go and re-interview everybody you can. Eyewitnesses, character witnesses, associates, colleagues, family members, friends, persons of interest, roommates. Everybody gets re-interviewed. Like you're just doing it for the first time. Then I would also go look at these people from a profile perspective. What were they involved with before this incident? What were they involved with after? 20 years later, 20 plus years later, what does their history look like? Have they committed any crimes of violence that would suggest they have a predisposition to violent acts? This is something you want to look into. I would also try to get information on every individual who was living in the area where Paula was living at the time. What do their criminal histories look like? Are there any similar crimes that occurred in a certain area, a certain radius of that area that may show that this is a pattern, that there may be one particular offender that we're looking for who was potentially identified in another crime and could be tied to this one. If this sounds like a lot of work, you're right, it is. This would be very intense, very involved, and very time-consuming, but it's the only way to do it right. And that would just be the start of it, right? I would also want to try to go and re-interview Lance. I would try to re-interview Cedric. And of course, I would try to re-interview Marcus. And for me, yes, Lance would be at the top of that list, right? You want to start with the person who knew your victim the best. You'd want to find out the specifics of the relationship at the time, see if he can actually open up and let you know what was really going on there. It may shed some light and it may also clear him, right? These are things I'd want to make sure that I tried to really narrow down so I understand what were the dynamics at the time when this transpired. Then I would turn my attention to Marcus, right? Marcus was living with her. Marcus was driving her car. What does he know? Where was he that day? Does he have an alibi? We have a 27-hour window, right? We're talking about 3 p.m. when she left Sam's Club and 6:30 p.m. the next day when she was supposed to make that phone call. It's a pretty big window, but maybe through the eyewitness testimony and re-interviewing people and talking to Marcus, we can start to narrow that window down to a smaller window where something could have happened. And in that case, who would have had access to her? And who would have had a motive? These are all things you have to do. I'm not saying it would be easy, but it's a necessary evil, and it's really the only chance we have. And that would be the investigative side to things, and there may be multiple pieces of information that lead down certain paths that I have to follow. But with the limited information I have, there's four theories that come to mind. The first one being, as always, a random act of violence, a stranger, someone who's not connected to our victim in any way, shape, or form, someone who saw her coming home from Sam's Club or saw her in her parking lot outside her apartment complex. There's a few different angles there where this person, regardless of how deep we dig, we're going to see no connection to them. This was just someone who was a demented individual who saw Paula alone and decided to act on it. If that's the case, and I've said this to you guys before, it makes it very difficult to solve because there's nothing that you can reverse engineer. The second theory would be that even though Lance more than likely wasn't physically capable of harming Paula and or Brandon, he contracted or enlisted the help of someone else to do something to her. Maybe it was to get possession of Brandon. Maybe it was to hurt her, take her out of the equation and put Brandon with someone else. And maybe he's still out there somewhere. You know me, I'm going to say it's possible. Do I think that's what happened? I don't. And honestly, from the outside looking in, I just don't think Lance gave a shit about Paula and really about Brandon either. Maybe a little bit more than Paula, but he really didn't care. From his behavior, it doesn't seem like he was really making an attempt to be with Brandon. So why would he go out of his way to do all this just to send Brandon off with someone else? The next two theories have a little bit more substance to them, and that would be someone who was connected to her that we just don't know publicly. Someone in that area who had a motive, who maybe found her attractive, had feelings for her, maybe was a neighbor or someone who worked with her and knew she was leaving and were upset about it. Maybe Paula didn't even know this person felt that way, but she did say to some people that she was in fear. So it leans in the direction of whoever did this, it was someone she was aware of, someone she knew. And that pool gets narrowed pretty quickly. So it could have been someone that was known to her that just hasn't been named publicly, or it could be someone that is known to law enforcement and they just haven't said the name. But that is a possibility, which brings us to our last theory, which is the most prominent. And when we think about what I just mentioned, one person that would check that box would be Marcus, right? Marcus was living with her. He was mooching off her. He wasn't helping out financially. He was driving her car. And maybe for all we know, he did have feelings for Paula and maybe she wasn't even aware of it, or maybe she was. And that's why she was telling people that she was afraid, because she knew by leaving Marcus was going to be upset. So would he have a motive to ensure that she didn't leave, even if it was just out of spite, if it was out of anger? Yeah. And if we're to believe what some have reported that he said out loud, I'm going to make sure she stays. couple that with how he was taking advantage of her at the time in the situation, I would call that motive. I would say that's a possibility that he was involved. And then you add in there his behavior after the fact, pulling up in Paula's car, taking off, reluctantly coming back. And then once he's finally cornered and asked to speak about the situation, he refuses, right? That doesn't seem like someone who wants to help. So I have a lot of questions about Marcus, and he may not provide them, but maybe Cedric will. And I want to turn my attention to Cedric. I had mentioned it in the episode, and I'll say it again here. Cedric, if you're hearing this or someone you know is hearing this or watching this, I will come to you or you can come here. I would love to speak with you. I would love to hear what you have to say. I don't know if you're still in prison, but if you're not, at this point would be the best time to talk, because I really don't have a lot to offer you other than you doing the right thing. And I think that should be enough. But if you want to reach out to me, I'm easy to find. I would love to speak with you. And lastly, I want to talk directly to Marcus. I don't know if you're going to see or hear this, but if you do, I'm offering you the same opportunity. I'll fly to you or you can come up here. And I'd love to speak with you. It can be on camera, it can be off camera, as long as we're both under the understanding that if you provide something critical, I'm going to turn it over to Paula's family and law enforcement. Because we should all want the same thing, right? To get answers for their family. And if you can help provide that, I'm willing to sit down with you. I'm concerned. I'm concerned you're not going to take me up on that offer the same way you haven't taken up the offer from law enforcement. And it's not because you're scared it's going to look bad for you. I feel you know more than you've said so far. What your involvement is, I don't know, but I'd love to find out. And so the offer's out there. I'd really respect the fact, even if you sat down with me for 20 minutes just to have a conversation, it could shed light on a lot of things and maybe clarify some things that would allow me to further vet what I know so far and maybe develop a different opinion on you in this situation. You've heard what I've had to say. I'm not hiding it from you. There's some concerns about your behavior before, during, and after. As you know, there are people out there who think you're responsible, and if this is an opportunity for you to clear your name, I think you should take advantage of it. In the meantime, we're not going to sit on our hands and just wait for something to happen. As I've mentioned, a lot of time has passed, and we've already lost a few people who died not knowing what happened to Paula and Brandon, and we're going to try to prevent that from happening again. So we have to make sure we spread the message. Watch this episode, listen to it, share it, pass it along to friends and family. Let's get the word out there. Let's create a public pressure on this case so that the people who are investigating it decide to do something about it or pass it on to people who will. So anybody out there who may be from that area may have information that could help solve this case. I want to recap it for you. 25-year-old Paula Wade and her 3-year-old son Brandon Wade were last seen on October 12, 2002 in Valdosta, Georgia. They were reported missing after Paula missed a scheduled call with her parents on the 13th and failed to show up for work on the 14th. More than 23 years later, their disappearance remains unsolved. At the time of her disappearance, Paula was 25 years old, 5 foot 7 inches tall, and weighed approximately 150 pounds. She is white with brown hair and brown eyes. She has a birthmark on the upper part of her leg and has front canine teeth that protrude. Brandon was just over 3 years old at the time. He was 2 feet 9 inches tall, weighed approximately 33 pounds, and had brown hair and hazel eyes. If you have any information about Paula and Brandon, please call the FBI's Atlanta field office at 770-216-3000. And to support Paula's family, please share their flyers and this episode. As always, my final words go out to the friends and family of Paula and Brandon, specifically Mary and Regis. I know you guys are carrying on the torch right now, and maybe sometimes you feel alone. I promise you, you're not. I'm here with you, and this community is here with you. We're going to fight until we get you the answers you deserve. And I want to personally apologize on behalf of law enforcement for what you've experienced over the years. It's unacceptable, and you should never feel like the people responsible for getting you answers are actually working against you. that's not how it's supposed to work. And I'm sorry that you're going through that. And I only hope that you don't lose complete faith in law enforcement, because there are good people out there who want to help you and get you the answers that you're seeking. And we're going to do what we can to make this right. I also want to say thank you for allowing me to share your sister's story. I know this is something that's very close to you and you care deeply about. And I appreciate you trusting me to tell her story, and I hope I did it justice. We have a lot of work to do. You've seen everything that I've talked about here. We need to get this in the hands of the right people and then start from the beginning. But until we do that, we're not going to find what we're looking for. And if there's anything I can do to help, I'm here. And I'm hoping that with the effort by everyone and this new exposure, this new coverage, that there's some movement and it leads to something where we're able to sit here and say, yeah, it took a long time, but we finally know what happened. And the person responsible, they're in custody. They're being held accountable for what they did. I really hope that day comes sooner than later. It's been far too long. Until then, please, everyone, stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1-3 and 7-day passes. Watch the Chase for the Cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.